its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Have you heard of WKAR's Community Cinema program? We've got a new season of our Community Cinema that debuts tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Let me tell you about it briefly. This is a screening and discussion of a new film called The Graduates, Los Graduados, this new documentary from Independent Lens, whose work you see on WKAR-TV weekly. This explores education today through the eyes of Latino and Latina adolescents from across the United States. We have a discussion panel planned for tomorrow evening's event also, and that will include Lansing School District Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul, and from MSU, education scholar Ruben Martinez of the Julian Zamora Research Institute. Now, this is tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock, here at Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State in East Lansing, 7 p.m. The event is free, but we ask that you register in advance, and you can reserve seats by visiting WKAR.org. Fairchild Hall is enjoying new acoustics in East Lansing. We'll explore that with Peter Worf coming up. Futurist Daniel Burris is also coming to Michigan. He's an amazing guy, and we'll be speaking with him later this hour. And we remember Orson Welles' unforgettable War of the Worlds controversy on the anniversary of the War of the Worlds broadcast. At the top of current state, Detroit's bankruptcy eligibility trial enters its fourth day today, with Governor Rick Snyder scheduled to testify. So far, federal judge Stephen Rhodes has heard municipal finance experts as well as emergency manager Kevin Orr claim that the city's Chapter 9 filing in July was the only option left to address major cash flow problems and billions in long-term debt. But attorneys representing creditors, which include retired city pension holders and municipal unions, are doing their best to persuade the judge that the filing was premature. That would keep alive hopes that the creditors' benefits may be protected as this situation plays out in court. Now, here to bring us up to speed on the bankruptcy hearing, we welcome Detroit Free Press reporter Brent Snavely. Hi, Brent.
Hi, good morning. How you doing?
Real well, thank you. It's good to have you on. After three full days of hearings now, could you briefly summarize for us what's been heard in Judge Rhodes' courtroom?
Sure. Well, primarily the testimony has been from two of the city's financial experts, investment banker Ken Buckfire and a partner from Ernst & Young. The police chief also testified. But really, there's been a lot of new financial information disclosed in the city's effort to prove that the city is or was indeed insolvent when it filed for bankruptcy. And insolvency is one of the criteria that the city needs to prove or show in order to be deemed eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, or in other words, to qualify for municipal bankruptcy protection.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Friday's paper, you and your colleague Nate Bolme wrote of the proceedings thus far, quote, "There didn't appear to be any major surprises that could derail Detroit's eligibility for bankruptcy." Were there any on Friday?
Yeah, but there was something significant that we view as significant on Friday that I think will be interesting to watch play out. Ken Buckfire, who, again, I said he's the co-president of Miller Buckfire, he is essentially the city's investment banker. He testified that as early as March of 2012, he and Jones Day, the law firm for the city of Detroit, had some preliminary discussions of some kind with the state about what a Detroit bankruptcy would entail and the ramifications of it. That's a lot earlier than generally was previously known. And I think what's going to happen is I think we'll see creditors really pounce on that detail and argue what they have been trying to argue all along, that the city and the state did not negotiate in good faith, that this all was a preordained plan, mm-hmm. and it was all orchestrated from the get-go to drive the city into bankruptcy. I think, however, that you'll see the city attorneys and the state attorneys just flip that argument the other way around and say, no, it doesn't prove that at all. It just proves that we were being prudent, we were exploring all options, and that bankruptcy was always a last-ditch option, and look how long we waited, and look how much we tried all the other options before we finally did it. So it'll be fascinating to watch that play out.
And today, of course, Governor Rick Snyder takes the stand, which is being described as historic. How do you expect that to play out?
Well, I can't remember ever seeing this happen where a governor takes a stand in a public trial of any kind, whether it's, you know, just a legal, you know, it's not a criminal trial, obviously, it is a procedural thing, but it's going to be very dramatic, and we're going to see creditors really, really try to push the governor for details on sort of what I was just talking about with Ken Buckfire, the decision timeline, when were decisions made, when did communications take place between the state and the city, Kevin Orr, Jones Day, about the strategy for dealing with the city's financial crisis, and, you know, and what does that show, and does it prove that the city and state were not negotiating in good faith?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they'll be pressing for.
Who determines who testifies in this trial, Brent? Can the union attorneys for, say, AFSCME call witnesses to bolster their case that the filing was premature?
You know, I apologize. I'm a little unclear on that. The sort of the procedures and who the decisions on who was going to testify took place on a day that I was not covering the trial.
Okay.
So I apologize. I'm a little unclear on that.
Okay. We'll point out that there are probably, you're one of four reporters for the Free Press who are attending the proceedings on and off.
Yeah, four, yeah. Really five. You know, again, yeah, we're in day four, and the proceedings have basically been going from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day.
Yeah.
And we've sort of rotated people in and out so that we're not... so that we can pursue other stories as well.
Sure, sure. We're talking with the Detroit Free Press's Brent Snavely about Phase 1, the bankruptcy eligibility phase of Detroit's bankruptcy trial. Now, another procedural question. Emergency manager Kevin Orr had meetings with various creditors. I want to say it was late summer. It was August or so. And suggested the city could pay back only pennies on the dollar overall. We seem to be revisiting all of that territory in this phase of the trial. Why is that?
Sure. Well, it was actually on June 14th, Kevin Orr unveiled a 134-page financial overview and proposal to creditors and held a huge meeting at Detroit Metro Airport to present the plan and to present in vague detail, frankly, but to present his desire and sort of plan for dealing with that. And then, to your point, there were some smaller meetings later in June and then in July in an effort to get creditors, unions, bondholders, insurers, to agree to certain concessions. To hear the city tell it, those meetings, those negotiations, those weeks were very intense, and yielded very, very little in the way of any tangible results from any creditors willing to give an inch on anything.
Mm.
The flip side of that argument is the creditors, the union attorneys especially, and union officials have said, these really weren't good faith negotiation meetings. This was Kevin Orr coming in and telling us what had to happen, and it was a one-way conversation, and they were not good faith negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that dynamic and the detail of those negotiations is sort of what will be playing out in the remainder of this trial.
How long is this eligibility phase expected to last?
Well, the judge initially scheduled 5 days of a eligibility trial. Tomorrow, Tuesday, would be the fifth day. They're running behind schedule. There are additional trial dates scheduled for next week. At this point, frankly, it's just been moving a little slower than expected. I don't think they'll get done by the end of the day tomorrow. So I think what we'll see is this trial will carry over. No additional dates are scheduled this week, but it'll carry over into next week.
Let's look at the two possible outcomes here. If Judge Rhodes rules the filing was justified, what happens after that?
Yeah, getting past eligibility for a municipality is a huge hurdle. It has taken a long time in most other Chapter 9 bankruptcies across the country. So what happens is once they are deemed eligible, then the city is indeed, you know, qualified for bankruptcy. It gains tremendous leverage over its creditors at that point. The city then has the ability to develop what technical term called the plan of adjustment. It's a reorganization plan.
Okay.
The city would develop a plan that it would submit to the court on how it plans to deal with its $18 billion in debt. And that's where we get into that cents on the dollar idea and concept, where the city will gain tremendous leverage to force its creditors to accept cents on the dollar for the debts that it owes. The city will still need to get at least one class or type of creditors, whether it's bondholders, unions, or insurers, or something like that, to vote in favor of that plan. So the creditors still have some power in bankruptcy negotiations, but they will have a lot less power than if the other thing happens, which you can ask about, which is that they would be deemed not eligible.
Right. And what happens in that case then?
Gosh, that is perhaps, I think, the best question to be asking. Really, we would be back to square one. We'd be back to the city struggling with immense financial obligations outside of bankruptcy, and they would need to then deal with these various groups of unions, insurers, bondholders, individually in an effort to restructure their debt without the leverage of Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And, you know, I think we've seen how difficult it even is with the leverage of bankruptcy for the city to negotiate. Really, frankly, we'd be back at square one with the city trying to renegotiate its debt. And, you know, before the city filed for bankruptcy, there were lawsuits beginning to emerge in a variety of different courts as creditors fought the city's efforts. It would be a tough thing.
And one last question. As this legal drama plays out, Brent, the city continues trying to function. From your vantage point, how is it doing?
Sure. You know, and this is a little bit of, I'll try to wear a little bit of two hats here. You know, I do live in the city of Detroit. I'm a resident. As a resident, frankly, I have not really seen much of a difference since July 18th when they filed for bankruptcy. I'd say services are the same, more or less, as they were before. We published the results of a public opinion poll a month or so ago that bore out the same thought. The public opinion poll showed that residents do not believe that city services have either improved, but they also haven't gotten worse. So I guess that's okay, but it is kind of a brewing issue for Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr, who, you know, early on when he was appointed in March and in subsequent interviews and public appearances said that under his management you will see services improve. And again, we have a public opinion poll showing that people don't think that there really have been any improvements.
All eyes on Detroit here in Michigan later today, awaiting Governor Rick Snyder's testimony in the eligibility phase of Detroit's bankruptcy trial. We've been talking with reporter Brent Snavely of the Detroit Free Press. Brent, thank you.
Thank you.
The Velvet Underground there, led by the late Lou Reed, Foggy Mind, that is called. You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. An MSU concert hall is receiving standing ovations after a recent overhaul. WKAR's Peter Wharf has the story.
before the Michigan State University College of Music's recent $20 million multi-venue renovations. Performers and audiences at MSU's Fairchild Theater found the venue itself was often the weakest part of the performance. That feeling is summed up by College of Music staff.
Unfortunately, the acoustics were a real problem.
Before, we had the slapback echo off the back wall.
Depending on where you sat, you would hear the music once, twice, or three times.
In the old space, the sound would go and would die.
And you'd have weird spots where you'd sit here and you couldn't hear this part of the ensemble or this part of the ensemble. You could hear really clearly one seat over.
It was a highly problematic acoustic.
These flaws made it difficult for listeners to have an enjoyable Fairchild musical experience. All this changes starting tonight as the fourth annual Joanne and Bill Church West Circle Series makes its much-anticipated move to MSU Auditorium's renovated and acoustically redesigned Fairchild Theater. MSU's College of Music enlisted the help of Portland, Oregon's Bora Architects, Detroit's Smith Group, and Chicago's Kierkegaard Associates to reimagine Fairchild. Anthony So is an associate with Kierkegaard and acoustical architect for the project. So's practice focuses on room acoustics and integration into architectural design. So's vision for Fairchild sound began with a multi-level approach.
It took quite a bit of investigative work to kind of peel back some of the layers to then, in the brain or in the mind, extrapolate, well, what does it mean if we take away the ceiling? What does it mean if we begin to take away some of these surfaces? And then how does the remaining kind of the bones or the structure, the fundamental structure of the building, how will that sound, right? And so that's one of the biggest kind of leaps in terms of the imagination as well. So it takes a little bit of experience and having been to other projects to kind of be able to see, well, wow, there's potential here.
Anthony So continues with some of the first major steps.
We took out the entire ceiling. Said that's going to go. Right. So now when you look up, you see the trusses, the structure.
We're looking at the rafters and I-beams and structure
exactly.
that holds up the roof.
Right. Exactly. And so what we're able to do is gain additional reverberation time, so more aliveness to the room, and also clean up the reflections. So you don't have hot spots. You know, every seat is a pleasant experience. You know, the other important part is expanding the orchestra pit to support opera program here. So this large orchestra pit allows for a reasonable stage depth to accommodate a wide range of ensembles. It also provides more generous elbow room, if you will, when it's down at the orchestra pit level. So all these are very critical in terms of finding the right balance of functionality as well as kind of the aesthetics, the oral aesthetics.
After Fairchild ceiling and orchestra pit redesigns, Anthony So realized acoustical improvements in the theater's newly conceived walls.
If you look around, you can see flat wood surfaces with very subtle shaping. Some of it you'll find is curved, and others is highly diffusive. So the upper side walls and rear walls in this instance, you can see are undulating waves, if you will, right?
What happens with these undulating waves that you're describing on the sides of the auditorium? What's the purpose?
Well, in a lot of the older halls, there's a lot of architectural decoration that goes on up there, from pilasters, arch windows, a lot of architectural detail. And it's important for diffusing or scattering the sound, making sure it mixes well in the room, right? And so when we talk about reverberation, we're not interested in the maximum time that the sound hangs in the air. It needs to sound good. And when you have just, you know, dead smooth parallel surfaces, that will actually create undesirable echo conditions. And so the idea is that in the lower zone of the room, where it's most proximate to the audience, we have relatively clean, smooth walls that are subtly shaped so that people from the stage, their sound from there, can project out in the most authentic way.
The College of Music kicked the new Fairchild Theater's tires in a day-long rehearsal for numerous ensembles last week. Jen Shangra was there. She's a recording engineer with MSU's College of Music. Shangra is responsible for documenting most every major music performance on the MSU campus. Jen's 14 years at State give her a strong perspective on the Fairchild Theater of old and its recent renaissance.
There's no comparison. Yeah. It's spectacular. We can actually do our jobs and do our jobs well, be able to let the music shine. From the recording standpoint, we have technical capabilities that we didn't have before. We used to set up in a small room backstage and have to truck things in every time. Now we have 24 channels upstairs. We have video. We have, that's just the technical side of it. Just audibly, it's amazing.
Of course, College of Music students look to Fairchild's reopening with perhaps the greatest anticipation, especially singers who previously struggled with performing in Fairchild's neighboring cavernous auditorium. Grad student Steve Martin, for instance.
I mean, Fairchild for us has been a long time coming. We have been waiting and waiting for something as beautiful as what Fairchild is. The sound is impeccable, and it finally has raised to the caliber of students that we have here. So it's really nice to actually visually have a reflection on the talent that is in the College of Music. Previously, I'm a vocalist, we would have operas over on the other side in the odd, and this is just such a more conducive space to have successful music making, where the other was a bit more of a struggle.
Months of College of Music construction have raised the bar not only for the Fairchild Theater, but also the 180-seat Cook Recital Hall, a performance space that's received equal praise from performers and concertgoers. College of Music Dean James Forger reflects on what this venue invigoration might mean for cultural advancement in Michigan.
To the great credit of President Simon and the leadership in the provost office, it's not just a symbol, it's a place for faculty and students to enhance their creative endeavors and research. It is a fabulous space. This has been a total transformation. It has been life-changing for these folks, and it brings tears to your eyes, actually.
For WKAR, this is Peter Wharf.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. 30 years ago, our next guest iced his reputation as a futurist and trend watcher when he accurately forecast a surprising array of largely unheard-of technology, digital electronics, genetic engineering, cloud computing, and others. Today, as the CEO of Burris Research, Daniel Burris has gone on to become an in-demand strategic advisor to companies around the world. Daniel Burris is also an app creator and the author of 6 books, including the bestseller Flash Foresight and Techno Trends. Mr. Burris is a keynote speaker at this Thursday's CEO Summit in Detroit, organized annually by the group Business Leaders for Michigan. Daniel Burris, welcome to Current State.
Hey, my pleasure to be here.
You must have been eating your ginseng back in 83, because in that year you predicted personal computers in every classroom, fiber optics, and a bunch of others. I have to ask, What was it about 1983 that brought about this torrent of amazing predictions?
Yeah, well, you know, what I did was I had already had started five companies. And by the way, before that, I taught biology and physics. So really, I'm a research guy. I'm a science guy who also was good at businesses. And I had sold those businesses in 1982 because I saw that there was something unique happening. We had, all of a sudden, I could see that we had these technologies on the horizon. Again, remember, I'm a science guy, so I was looking at this anyway. And I could see that they would have an impact, but I wasn't sure what. So I spent a year doing research, nothing but research, and came up with what I called the taxonomy of high technology. In other words, I came up with the key categories that would drive economic growth from that point forward, and I came up with the concept of hard trends versus soft trends. By the way, hard trends will happen. If you don't like them, too bad. Soft trends might happen. So by separating those two, you could gain a lot. So what I did is I came up with a big series of predictions based on those that research, and the rest is history. I've been doing it every year, and I've been giving thousands of speeches around the world and consult with companies and 6 books. I've got a blog with 3 million weekly readers, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's worked out really well.
Can you share with us how you connected the dots on just one of these predictions? Is there one that stands out?
Yeah, well, it's hard to pick just one that stands out, but I think I know what you're trying to get at there, and that is that, first of all, if you want to be really right about predicting where things are going, which I've done for 30 years, I'll give you a secret. You leave out the parts you can be wrong about. Now,
how convenient.
Now you think, well, that sounds simple. But the key is what's left is amazing, because we think, general thinking is, you can only, death and taxes. That's all you can predict. The rest of it's up in the air. Yet we all know when Father's Day will be. We know when the full moon will be in 2020 in March. We know when the next presidential election will be. In other words, and we know that the next iPhone will have a faster processor, and we know that after 3G and 4G wireless, it will not stop there. It'll be 5G and 6G. In other words, we know so much that in reality, every disruptive technology that has disrupted every single business was there to see. People just didn't know how to look, and what I've done is come up with a way to look so that you can see those things, because what I'm going to be talking about at the CEO Summit, for example, is how being a disruptor or the disrupted, you do have a choice, because it's all there to see once you know how to look.
How do you interact with people who have a fear of disruption?
Well, I think that what we have a fear of is change that we didn't see coming. For example, the old saying is that people don't like change, and I disagree with that. Babies are born loving change. They prefer rapid change, as a matter of fact. So they get changed a lot. So in other words, and when we take vacations, we like change. I mean, hey, that's why we take vacations. But the kind of change that we don't like is the kind that catches us by surprise and we didn't see it coming. However, most of those changes, again, were there for you to see. When do people get burglar alarms? After getting robbed. When do people start exercising? When the doctor says you're going to die if you keep sitting in the chair. When do we work on relationships? As we enter divorce court. Hey, maybe we should talk. In other words, we're crisis managers. And my goal, my driving force for 30 years, and I'm going to keep going until I can't go any further, is to say, look, we do have crises, we do have fires to put out, but there are amazing opportunities, and there's an amazing amount of certainty in this uncertain world. Look at those things, and you can come up with a list of what will happen and profit from it.
Mm. We're talking with futurist and trend watcher Daniel Burris of Burris Research. What future possibility excites you most here in October of 2013?
Well, it's what really is, and I'm going to give you a short-range prediction. And by the way, most futurists don't do that because you might remember it. I'm going to give you a short-range prediction for all of the listeners, and I want you to remember this because it's going to happen. It's based on the science of hard trends. In other words, this is going to happen. Over the next 5 short years, and it's technology-driven, we're going to transform, not just change. We're going to transform how we sell, how we market, how we communicate, how we collaborate, how we innovate, how we train, how we educate. In other words, it's if you see that, you might say, oh, I didn't know how bad it was. But that's one way to look at it. I look at it as I didn't know how good it was. Because what we're doing is the playing field is once again being leveled, and we have tools that allow us to get new advantage. So it doesn't matter how bad it's been in our region, and whether it's Michigan or it doesn't matter if you pick another state. What we have is new tools to redefine core processes that every business does. Somebody's going to get rich. Why don't you?
Hmm. Which future possibility worries you the most? Do you go there? Do you go to you must run into trends
absolutely.
That you
I'll
fear.
I'll tell you exactly. Yeah. I'll tell you exactly what does. It is the fact that uncertainty is spreading. Look at our own government. We have matter of fact, if you do the math, we're losing about 2% of growth a year because of uncertainty. When you're uncertain, what happens? You do not hire. You do not start businesses. You don't know what courses to take in college. You don't write checks. Uncertainty keeps us stuck. And it's not just this country. It's, you know, look at Europe. Even China's uncertain. Everybody's got all this uncertainty. On the other hand, that's what worries me, uncertainty. However, the opposite is more powerful. Because when you have certainty, that's when you have confidence to start a company, hire 100 more employees, go forward. So in the so my fear is that we will be drowning in uncertainty and not move forward with the opportunities that are indeed real and they're in front of us. To offset that, my personal mission I've assigned myself is to help people to see the science of certainty and how powerful certainty can be. As a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons I think why my book Flash Foresight got to the New York Times bestseller list so rapidly.
You just spoke a few seconds ago about the next 5 years. This is the possibility that excites you more, the revolutionizing sales, marketing, teaching. Can you tell us any more about that? I mean, how is that going to unfold exactly?
Yeah. Well, let me just give you a quick example. It's like Monty Python. All right. They were selling DVDs on Amazon of their old programs, their old comedy shows. And then when they took little snippets of those shows and put them on YouTube, within 2 months, the sales of the DVDs on Amazon went up 29,000%. Rapper 50 Cent, he was paid $10,000 to do one tweet to promote a product. Just one tweet, that's two sentences. Whoa, $10,000 for two sentences sounds like a lot. But when you realize that in 24 hours the sales went up, 105 million, you start realizing, I guess he was underpaid. So in other words, we are transforming things, all of these processes, at an amazing speed. And businesses do a lot of informing, but communicating is where the action is. And, of course, what do we have there? A social revolution. People are asking themselves, should I get an iPhone or should I get an Android device of some kind? Wrong question. A better question is, how do I use mobility to transform how we educate or how we train or how we communicate or how we collaborate? Then you'll start getting better answers. So what I want us to do is ask, you know, better questions. One last little tidbit here about that. Let's focus us on healthcare. We just had healthcare reform, but actually it was health payment reform. Let's face it, it didn't give you a better artificial knee. It didn't. What we did didn't do anything other than work on the, it's getting more expensive, how are we going to pay for this? Let's look at the opposite. Let's use mobility and the cloud and all these technologies to transform how hospitals and healthcare purchase, logistics, supply chain. By transforming those functions, you could take so many billions of waste out of the system that you wouldn't have to worry about how you're going to pay for it. The prices are now not going up, they're going down. So, you know, we're looking at the wrong thing. So what I want us to do is make sure we're looking at the right thing. In other words, it's one of the principles I like to talk about is whatever problem you've got, that's not it. In other words, hey, you're smart. You would have solved it by now. You're working on the wrong one. You have to skip the problem you think you have and to get down to the real problem so that you can, the one I just gave you was a good example. If we were solving the problems of how we purchase supply chain logistics and all those things within hospitals and our healthcare system, in other words, redefine the back end, the front end would be very inexpensive.
This is one of the more talked about parts of your book, Flash Foresight, Skipping Your Biggest Problem.
Yeah, let me give you another quick example,
sure.
Real quickly. And, you know, this is about a 60 seconds. I know we don't have a lot of time. A number of years ago, I was talking to a big drug company, Eli Lilly. They said, we got a problem. Right away, I had an advantage because I knew whatever they would say, that wasn't it. And they said, well, our problem is we've got to hire about 2,000 additional PhD researchers, and we don't have the budget. Now, right away, I knew that wasn't it, so I started asking, why do you got to do that? And they said, our stock price of our company is in direct proportion to how many new drugs are in the pipeline. To get new drugs in the pipeline, we need to solve molecular problems. To solve molecular problems, we need researchers. We're short on researchers. We need more, but we don't have the budget. So then I invoked the principle. I said, well, good. Let's skip that. So what did they end up doing? Well, they took all of their molecular problems, put them on the internet in a dozen languages, and said, we pay for solutions. So it didn't take long, and they had more than 2,000 PhD researchers from all over the world submitting solutions, and Eli Lilly purchased the solutions that they wanted to purchase.
Hmm.
In other words, the problem wasn't the problem. On a simple level, people might say, hey, I can't save money. Hey, I'm having trouble. I just can't save money. No wonder. Wrong problem. If they were working at how they spent money, they would save money by default. Working on the wrong one.
I sometimes worry that the accelerating pace of change will make our day-to-day lives harder than they'd already be, especially as more of American society grows old. I'm talking about baby boomers here. Am I right to worry? I mean, does rapidly accelerating change pose more challenges than ever for older people?
Well, it poses challenges if we don't change how we think and learn some new things. You know, there's an old saying that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. The good news are, we're not dogs. We can learn new things. I remember my 83-year-old mother, when she was starting to learn how to work a computer, had a little trouble at first, but when I got her to have one of her grandkids teach her how to do it, all of a sudden, she had it was fun. She learned how to do it. Hey, then she started taking classes on it, and she's quite good at it. In other words, you took an old dog and taught her a new trick, and she's now doing pretty good. So I think that we have amazing ability to learn and adapt. The key is, are we just sitting back and doing nothing, or are we learning, adapting, which, by the way, helps your mind stay young as well.
Daniel Burris is the author of 6 books. The Futurist and Trend Watcher is in Detroit on Thursday at the CEO Summit, which is organized annually by the group Business Leaders for Michigan. Daniel Burris, great to talk to you.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. 75 years ago, radios across America crackled to the sound of this ominous revelation.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own.
With those words, actor and director Orson Welles led the nation through a chilling tale of a Martian invasion of Earth. And with more on this memorable anniversary, we're joined by WKAR's Kevin Lavery. Hey, Kevin.
Good morning, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
What do you have for us here?
Well, the radio broadcast, of course, was just a story. But the War of the Worlds on October 30th, 1938, set off a wave of panic across the country and became an American cultural touchstone. Now, Mark, there is a new connection to this old legend. Brad Schwartz is a 2008 graduate of Okemos High School and of the University of Michigan. He is a credited co-writer in an upcoming documentary on the War of the Worlds that we are airing tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on WKAR-TV. He studied hundreds of letters to Orson Welles that conveyed the surge of emotions felt by millions of people on that memorable night. I first asked Brad about his passion for the golden age of radio.
My parents, when I was growing up, always had a hard time getting me to sleep at night, so they would get me these cassettes of shows like The Shadow or the Mercury Theater on the Air. So I'd heard all these, and I knew the voice of Orson Welles as a young person. You know, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
The Shadow knows.
You know, I remember that very well.
By the time you got to high school here in this area, Okemos High School, you started honing in on the War of the Worlds as a class project. Tell me a bit about that and how that also continued once you got to college, too.
Yeah. I had a teacher in high school in ninth grade, Mr. Matt Morrison, who I had for U.S. history. And we did kind of the history version of a science fair. I was part of the unit on the 1930s, so somebody did a project on Franklin Roosevelt. Somebody did, you know, John Dillinger. And I ended up with Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds. So in addition to a poster board, I had a microphone set up and a music stand so my fellow students could reenact portions of the broadcast. When I got to the University of Michigan and I was studying, I was double majoring in history and film, what they call screen arts and culture, I discovered in my junior year, thanks to a friend who works in the library, whose name is Phil Hallman, that the U of M has these two massive collections of Orson Welles' personal papers donated by some of his associates. They were very new then. They'd only just been donated in 07, and few people had really gone through them. And I heard that among these collections were about 1,400 letters that he had received, and he and the Mercury Theater had received from people who heard the War of the Worlds in 1938. And nobody had gone through them since that event. You know, this would have been nearly 75 years ago when I discovered it, 75 years ago now. And so I thought, what a great treasure trove of material that's right up my alley. And as luck would have it, I was just beginning the process at Michigan to do a history thesis. And I needed a topic, and the professor I had at the time said, why don't you look into this a little more? There's your project. And we were off and running.
So from that, you eventually decided to take a leap and reach out to public television, specifically to the staff of the PBS show American Experience. How did that unfold?
Well, they reached out to me. It's kind of a funny story. So I wrote this thesis that is the second longest in the history of the University of Michigan, using these letters and about 600 others that were at the National Archives that had been written to the FCC. To kind of analyze the response to the broadcast in a way that hadn't yet been possible. And that summer, I needed a summer job because I still had a term of college to do. And so I applied for an internship at American Experience in Boston. An internship I couldn't end up taking, but as part of the application, I sent them a few pages from the thesis. And they, as luck would have it, the executive producer, Mark Sammels, is a tremendous Orson Welles fan. He knew the 75th anniversary was coming up, and he really wanted to do a show. And I just happened to come through the door with new material that nobody else had used right when they were beginning to develop the show. So they, instead of giving me an internship, they gave me a job co-writing the show.
Very serendipitous.
I know.
Let's listen to some clips from that classic broadcast, The War of the Worlds. This was on Mischief Night, October 30th, 1938, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Millions of people across the country are listening. If you're lucky enough to live on the West Coast, maybe you've got a little bit of daylight left, but it is pitch black on the East Coast, including the area around Princeton, New Jersey, which is where this fictitious Martian invasion takes place. The broadcast starts off pretty normally. It starts with a weather forecast, and then there's some ballroom music from New York City.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
So this is the age before wall-to-wall news coverage, way before CNN. They just go right back to the music after this startling announcement, almost like it never even happened.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, if you've, like I have, if you've listened to a lot of news broadcasts from the day, that was, this sounds exactly like what they would have done. Oftentimes they used piano music as filler before they had more information. Now they just keep talking. But so this was a very close copy of what a news broadcast of the day sounded like.
Later on in the broadcast, we hear from a reporter named Carl Phillips. He's now on the scene in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. He's at the site of a farm where this mysterious object has crashed, and things are heating up now at Grover's Mill.
Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! Oh, the whole field caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission.
That's a really key part in the show, and that's a moment when you read in the letters a lot of the people who were frightened. That's either when they tuned in or when they were convinced that this was real, because it sounds so realistic.
What were some of the things people said about this?
Sure. Well, yeah, these are a couple of the letters that are dramatized as actors in the show. So let me read one. This is from Sunland, California, and it was written November 1st, 1938. Dear Mr. Wells, really, kerhum kerump, you delivered the 100% imaginative bang of any century last evening. Took a minute for the tubes to warm up, then over the air came the following. Something wrong. A musical interlude will follow until communication is reestablished. The organ no sooner got underway than it was cut off, and the following came filtering through. The cylinder lies in a deep crater. No signs of life is evident.
Black the battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray.
People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats.
And as the radio drowned out calamity, catastrophe, and chaos, we increased our appearance of bug-eyedy, and our jaws sagged lower and lower. Well, all I can say is, Mr. Wells, that you have undoubtedly made the shades of Keene, Booth, Mantell, and all others once great crazy with rage, and had best stick around here until they cool down. Go to it, and more power to you. I'll be listening, just you bet, and be on at 5 sharp hereafter. Congratulations. I am sincerely yours, Seymour Charles Hayden.
Bug-eyedy.
Bug-eyedy, exactly. That's what made this such a fun project to do my thesis on, because, you know, every one of these letters has a very unique voice and oftentimes a very unique vocabulary, as you could tell. I mean, it's when you read that, it's like you can hear this fellow talking. And so to see this letter and several others come to life in this American Experience show has been really unique.
It just doesn't come across the same way on Twitter, does it?
No, not at all. But these are very much the Twitter and Facebook of their day, because in 1938, this is the only way you had to reach out to a broadcaster or anybody. So this was how people registered their opinions in much the same way they do now.
Finally, at the end of the broadcast, Orson Welles comes out of character. Here comes this 23-year-old whiz kid, the mastermind at CBS Mercury Radio Theater, to basically say April Fool's. About 7 months late, although it does coincide, of course, nicely with another holiday that's coming up. And here's what Orson Welles has to say to America after this tremendous scare.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
you're 23, the same age Orson Welles was, and now you have a co-writing credit in this documentary. That's got to be overwhelmingly amazing. You must be standing on Orson Welles' shoulders.
Absolutely. It's fun to have my own War of the Worlds broadcast at that age. You know, it's a wonderful professional distinction to have at the beginning of my career. I also wrote a student film at Michigan that premiered in Traverse City at the Traverse City Film Festival this past summer. Just so to have two projects that I worked on as a writer premiere in the same year at this age, I'm feeling very fortunate to have that.
Brad Schwartz is an Okemos High School and University of Michigan alum. He helped co-write the upcoming PBS American Experience documentary on the 75th anniversary of the War of the Worlds. It airs tomorrow night at 9 on WKAR-TV. Brad, it has been absolutely wonderful sharing this classic story with you. Thank you and happy Halloween.
And happy Halloween to you as well.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations coast to coast has brought you The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, the 17th in its weekly series of dramatic broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. Next week, we present a dramatization of three famous short stories. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we take a closer look at Lansing's proposed marijuana ordinance. Also, Current State contributor Gary Wilson joins us for Great Lakes Month in Review. That and more Tuesday on Current State. You've been also hearing selections today from The Velvet Underground on Current State. The group's Lou Reed died over the weekend at the age of 71. We've heard Foggy Notion and Oh Sweet Nothing. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.